We've talked about the central role of concentration in the mystical or enlightenment path all around the world, and how one can use the concentration as a kind of microscope to experience in a very clear and detailed way the nature of our experience. The basic model for the spiritual path in the mindfulness or vipassana tradition is that we take some aspect of ordinary experience, infuse it with a high degree of mindfulness. Mindfulness means when we use the concentration power to keep track of the components and subcomponents that constitute an experience. And we also infuse that experience with a quality called equanimity. Equanimity means we use the concentration power to detect the natural movement of the flow pattern, you might say, of the components of the experience, and then we get out of the way. We give permission for them to expand, to contract, to be still, to do whatever they naturally would do. So it's a radical non-interference with the natural flow of our senses. That's what equanimity is. And the basic model is that one can take any aspect of experience and cultivate mindfulness and equanimity with that experience, or put alternatively, we can take any aspect of experience and infuse mindfulness and equanimity into that experience. Those are basically the same thing. As we attempt to be precise, as we attempt to be allowing with respect to that experience, on one hand, we are cultivating our skills of precision and allowing, mindfulness and equanimity. On the other hand, we could say that we are infusing mindfulness and equanimity into that experience. Now, as the result of greeting experiences this way, both in formal sitting practice and just in day-to-day life as we're doing things, a process of insight and purification is catalyzed. I like this word catalyzed, catalysis. It's a term from chemistry. It refers to adding something to a reaction that doesn't really participate in the reaction. It doesn't, in a sense, change what is there. But the presence of this something called the catalyst radically affects the velocity at which the reaction takes place, usually speeding up the reaction. That's what a catalyst is. Everybody, whether they know it or not, is involved in the path to enlightenment. Just by virtue of living daily life, nature is constantly pulling us, or if you want to say God, God's grace is constantly pulling us, really the same thing in my book, to the enlightened state. The only difference between a mystic, a meditator, and any other person is the speed at which one is moving along this path. You might say that the meditator, by infusing a little bit of mindfulness and equanimity into the ordinary experience, doesn't really change what is there. The thoughts are still there. The feelings are still there. But the presence of the mindfulness and equanimity functions like a catalyst, and it dramatically speeds up a natural process of insight and purification. Insight is a many-faceted jewel. We've already talked about some facets or sides of the insight experience. One gains the insight that physical and emotional pain don't have to turn into suffering. Suffering equals pain multiplied by resistance to the pain. One gets the insight that pleasure will yield deeper satisfaction if we don't grasp onto it, tighten around it microscopically, instant by instant. One gains insight into how the sense of self arises as a tangling of thought and feeling, and how to have a complete sense of self. And also one gains insight into how to temporarily let go of the sense of self and have an experience of merging with a, quote, other. So one gains insight into how to have a healthy sense of individuality, and one gains insight into how to have a healthy merging or uniting with an other. Other could be another human, or a flower, or one's whole surrounding scene, or the whole universe, or the source of the universe. One gains insight into how the source of the universe functions, how not only one's sense of self, but one's sense of surrounding scene is literally fermented into existence by the polarization and vibration that arises from this very special nothing, which is called God or our source. How time, space, self, and world arise, at least in terms of our subjective experience, in terms of how our moment-by-moment consciousness functions. Well, that's a very deep insight. These are all facets of the insight process, and the basic premise of mindfulness meditation, Vipassana meditation, as it is called, is that by merely consistently infusing the qualities of mindfulness and equanimity into ordinary experience, with time, these various facets of profoundly significant new understandings arise for us. In addition to the aspect of insight, and I've only touched on a few facets or sides, there is also the aspect of what is called purification. Most growth modalities, from 19th century psychotherapy to late 20th century Scientology and just about everything in between, share a common fundamental model or paradigm when you really look at the basics. That paradigm goes something like this. We hold influences from the past that limit our behavior and perception in the present, and our job is somehow to get rid of those limiting forces. Whether you want to call them imprints or engrams or complexes or unresolved residues of former experience, lots of different names could be used. In the Buddhist tradition, they're called sankharas, which means something like impressions. These impressions are located deep in what in the West is called the unconscious. We're not aware of them on the surface. But we notice that despite our best intentions on the surface of our consciousness to be different, year after year, we seem to be pulled into the same grooves. And despite the fact that the surface of our consciousness may believe that there is a spiritual reality constantly present, what we experience is just separateness and materiality and impatience and discomforts and banality. We don't seem, each time we turn our head, have a beatific vision, or each time a new thought arises, have that be in contact with the spiritual source, or have each body sensation be the touch of the Holy Spirit. For most people, that's not their day-to-day, minute-by-minute, second-by-second experience. If we really are embedded in spiritual reality, why don't we see it? Why isn't every vision beatific to us? The reason is the presence of these limiting forces deep, deep, deep down in the unconscious. Purification could be described as a process that breaks up this material, digests it, metabolizes it, excretes it, if you will. But some way we get free from these limiting grooves that influence our behavior in the macroscopic time frame over long periods of time and influence our perception every second. And as these grooves get worn away, we find that remarkable, spontaneous, and effortless positive changes in the way we act are taking place. And indeed, we also find that our perception of ordinary experience becomes much more unitive, and much more spiritual, much more naturally loving. So that's the process of purification. Just as the insight process has many facets to it and also has many depths to it, the insight into the fact that suffering equals pain multiplied by resistance, a person may well have when they begin their practice within a few weeks when they get that insight. The direct experience of nothingness polarizing and producing the self and seen, that insight may take a few years or maybe considerably longer to come. So there's a whole hierarchy of insights, some lighter, some deeper, in addition to the fact that there are many sides to insight. In the same way, there are many sides to the purification process, and the purification process goes deeper and deeper, scouring finer and finer and finer levels of subconscious blockage. There are a lot of different ways that we can talk about the purification process. If you want to use a theological paradigm, you can say that purification is the elimination of our sinfulness, that which lies at the base of our being and separates us from God. If that paradigm works for you, that model works for you, that's just fine. That's more or less the Christian paradigm. For example, in the Eastern Orthodox Church, they have a lot of meditation, the Greek and Russian Orthodox Church, a lot of meditation, rather similar to mindfulness meditation as it's done in Buddhism. And the whole idea is catharsis. Catharsis, the Greek word for cleansing, that you can actually cleanse away your sinfulness and experience theosis. Theosis, theos in Greek means God. Theosis is literally becoming like God. That's the goal in the Eastern Orthodox form of Christianity. They would use the model that the purification is the elimination of the sin that separates us from God. Like I say, that's a model. If you like it, fine. There are other ways of looking at it. The Buddhists tend to look at it a little bit more like a moral model. We have craving, aversion, unconsciousness. These are the three basic kleshas. Impurities, not impurity so much in the sense of something bad, but impurity in the sense that gold ore has something mixed in it that's other than gold. Its nature is gold, but there's something else mixed in there. Purification means the removing of that which is foreign to the gold, leaving just gold. So according to Buddhism, citta pakati visuddha, it means consciousness by nature is pure. But these habits of craving, aversion, and unconsciousness come in adventitiously. Adventitiously means they belong there, they just come from the outside. They get mixed in with consciousness and lead to suffering. Purification in the Buddhist sense is the elimination of the qualities of craving, aversion, and unconsciousness. Then the ore is refined. There's nothing left but the pure gold of consciousness, what there always was, the pure activity of the source. So that's another paradigm. If you want to take a psychological paradigm for purification, we can say that there are many memories and incomplete experiences and holdings stored in the unconscious. And as we infuse mindfulness and equanimity into whatever is present, that percolates down into the unconscious and gives the unconscious what it needs to metabolize those memories. Unlike, however, the psychological model, in Buddhism, it is not necessary to remember specific events. Some specific events may percolate to the surface while you're meditating, so-called repressed memories. And of course, when that happens, you are aware of what part of it is thought, what part of it is body sensation. You infuse the thoughts and body sensations with mindfulness and equanimity, and then that cleanses away that particular holding from the past. However, according to Buddhism, most of the purification of the incomplete residues from the past experiences does not come through consciously remembering specific things. And this is one of the main differences between the psychological paradigm and the Buddhist paradigm of purification. According to the Buddhist paradigm, most of the purification comes because the clarity from the mindfulness and the matter-of-factness from the equanimity trickle down. They seep down into the unconscious. The unconscious does its work directly on its own. So often when we sit there and meditate, we're not really aware consciously of any, quote, progress. It just seems like we're sitting there most of the time, our mind's wandering. When our mind's not wandering, it's going to sleep. And then we become aware that we're physically uncomfortable. Then we come back to our object of meditation for a couple seconds, and then our mind's wandering, and then we're back to the object of meditation for a couple seconds, and then once again we're aware of wanting to move and being uncomfortable. And it doesn't seem like anything is really happening of value. You come back from a meditation retreat and you talk to your friends, you know, what did you do? You describe this, and they say you paid good money for this. You know, it's like, what's the point? But while all that is going on, the mindfulness and equanimity is trickling down. I call this the trickle-down theory of enlightenment. The unconscious, without the conscious knowing it, is rewiring itself. That gives the unconscious what it needs to change its hard wiring. How do we know? We know because after a retreat or after a number of retreats or after we have developed a momentum of some kind of regularity in our practice, we start to notice that our behavior and perception is changing spontaneously, and we're not sure exactly why. It's almost as though somebody did plastic surgery on your soul. You went under the anesthesia, you know, when you woke up, you looked different, and you're not quite sure what happened in between. So a lot of the learning that takes place with the mindfulness practice is of this category. The psychological paradigm, we have holdings from the past, but they get worked through, that's purification. That's another way to look at the process. But as I say, in Buddhism and in psychotherapy, you look at it a little bit differently. Another possible paradigm for the purification process is actually a mechanical or mechanistic paradigm. And I sort of like this one. According to this paradigm, the six senses, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, the feeling body, and the thinking mind, have a kind of viscosity to them. Just like honey, you've probably heard the expression flowing like honey on a cold day, okay? It doesn't flow very much. It moves, but pretty slowly. On the other hand, if you warm up the honey, same substance, but it becomes incomparably more fluid. So we say that the honey on a cold day has more viscosity to it. The senses, all six of them, have a kind of subtle internal friction. It's actually something like muscle tension in that it's the system working against itself, parts of the system working against themselves, self-conflict. But it's microscopic self-conflict. In fact, that's another major difference between the paradigm of therapy and the paradigm of meditation. Therapy also talks about getting rid of self-conflict, and that's important. But they're talking about getting rid of macroscopic, conscious self-conflicts, or bringing middle-sized self-conflicts that may be subconscious to the surface. That's all very important, but in meditation, the emphasis is on dealing with microscopic self-conflicts that are present hundreds and hundreds of these tiny moments of self-interference are present in each activity of the senses as they process moment by moment. And we're never aware of this. We're only aware of it once it starts to go away a little bit. And what this microscopic congealing or glitching or freezing in the flow of the six senses brings about is a kind of friction, internal friction. It is what causes our visual field to congeal and give the impression that space is rigid. It's what causes our body sensation to congeal and give the impression that the body is material, etc., etc. From this view, there's something like friction or microscopic self-conflicts that are constantly present in the flow of the senses. As we infuse mindfulness and equanimity into the flow of the senses, that internal friction becomes reduced and our senses now start to flow more like the warm honey. And then they flow more like steam. And that's why we say spirit. That's when you become spirit. That's what spirit means. Spirit means breath, air, steam. Qi in Chinese literally means steam. All that breath is, all that steam is just solid matter that is no longer congealed, no longer frozen. It's able to flow with almost no viscosity. What it means to be spiritual, spiritualis, to be of the spirit, of the breath, as opposed to being corporeal or, quote, body, so to speak, is not to be somehow different from the material or the corporeal. What it means to be spiritual is just to be material or corporeal, but without any viscosity. So it goes from being ice to being flowing water, and then flowing water to being steam. It's still H2O. So the six senses, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, the feeling body, and the thinking mind, are still the six senses. But when that internal viscosity is removed, then they may well be called spirit. That's another paradigm for the purification process, the elimination of this incredibly microscopic, ubiquitous, and invisible inner friction from the substance of consciousness itself. So that's a little bit more of a rheological or hydrodynamic model. Rheology, you may not know the term, but it's the study of how things flow in nature. These are various aspects or models of the purification process. The basic paradigm is that we take ordinary experience, we infuse it with mindfulness and equanimity, just to the best of our ability, which probably won't be all that great, but we attempt to. Once again, mindfulness is applying the concentration to be aware of everything that makes up that experience in terms of the six senses. And equanimity is a radical hands-off attitude with the subjective side of experience. Of course, equanimity does not for a moment imply that one is indifferent to objective external events. One could be very hands-on with respect to objective external events. It's very hands-on. You're pushing and pulling. If it's too cold, turn on the heat. You're pushing and pulling. On what? External events. The objective world. But as the sensations of hot and cold spread through your body, they have a natural flow pattern. Don't push and pull on that. Because if you push and pull on that, you're interfering with whom? With yourself. So that's subtle self-conflict. Equanimity means a hands-off attitude only in the sense of non-interfering with oneself, not pushing and pulling on the natural flow pattern of the senses. Equanimity could actually be described as a sort of internal passivity that actually frees up energy so that we can externally be more active or more effective. That reminds me of a story which might serve as an example of this kind of thing. I've had the privilege of being on the receiving end of what we might call enlightened anger. I got into a little argument with one of my teachers once. He got sort of angry, you know, and sort of waving his finger and raising his voice and vociferously attacking me and making all the movements that we usually associate with somebody being pretty pissed off. And so I walked away from this, the usual thoughts going through your head of, he's full of shit, et cetera, et cetera. And then I happened to notice that I was smiling. Well, why am I smiling? And then I went into meditation, brought my awareness into my body. My whole body was full of incredibly pleasant sensations, as though I had had a massage, a body work. And then I realized what had happened. I knew exactly what had happened. I had enough experience in meditation to recognize what the teacher had done, although I did not have enough experience in meditation to replicate it myself at that time. When we get angry, our body fills with the unpleasant sensations of anger. It's a flavor, a quality of sensation. A person that's a real enlightened master feels the same angry qualities in their body as anybody else when they encounter a situation that they don't like. But there is a difference. They experience them with full mindfulness and equanimity. Therefore, there is no viscosity. It turns into a kind of effortless flow of energy, which then can be allowed to spill over into words and gestures. But those words and gestures are, number one, more appropriate than they would be otherwise because they are not driven by internal suffering. They're only motivated or riding on a flow of pure sensation. But not only that, because that person is experiencing their anger as actually a kind of pleasure, even though it's pain, it has a certain pleasure to it because of the fact that it's so fluid. A real enlightened master experiences their anger like a massage that is cleaning them out, that is nurturing them, purifying them, vitalizing them. And in point of fact, I had on occasion heard this master say, "You don't have to worry about my age. I know you're always worried that I'm going to die because I'm so old, but as long as I'm getting angry, I'm healthy." Now, that seems like the exact opposite of what any ordinary person would say, right? That's type A behavior. The person's getting angry. That's supposed to, like, shorten their life. Now, is this just one of these funny things that Zen masters figure out to say to blow people's minds? No. It's complete sincerity. He's talking completely ingenuously. As long as he's angry, he's being massaged. It's not pain. It's the flow of nature. Well, there's a subtle difference in the quality of movement and voice that comes out of a person who is experiencing fluid anger, a difference between that and the quality of voice and body movement that comes out of somebody who is experiencing the suffering of anger. If you're sensitive, you actually feel the difference. So what he actually did when he was gesticulating and yelling at me was, of course, massage me. He was communicating directly the flow of the energy that he was experiencing directly to my body. My mind at first was tripped out on the content of the interaction, but that went away fairly quickly. And as soon as I felt what I actually had in the body, I started to think, ah, yeah, I see what he did. I understand this. I can't do it, but I understand it. And I'd like to be able to do this someday. The phrase that occurred to me was this French expression, coup de maître. In French, coup de maître. It means the masterstroke, the show of virtuosity. Doing something that the ordinary performer can't do is the masterstroke. Something like that, having a real interaction where he's really expressing his concerns, taking care of business, feeling a lot of emotion, but at the same time instructing about insight and purification to the student, if the student's sensitive enough to realize what's happening. The basic paradigm, we take ordinary experience, do our best to infuse mindfulness and equanimity into it. As a result of that, it catalyzes or speeds up a natural process of insight and purification. When that process reaches a certain critical momentum or critical mass, then we start to have complete experiences. Our ordinary experiences go from having relative mindfulness and equanimity to absolute mindfulness and equanimity. When there is absolute mindfulness and equanimity, which even for great masters does not happen all the time, but happens a lot of the time, then the experience becomes complete, and any complete experience is like any other complete experience because it contains everything and yet is extremely vacuous at the same time. It's totally paradoxical. Complete pain causes very little suffering. Complete pleasure brings lasting satisfaction and doesn't turn into a neediness. A complete experience of confusion forms the basis for intuitive spiritual wisdom. total paradox. And a complete experience of boredom is endlessly fascinating. You transcend boredom when it's complete. The completeness is very paradoxical. A complete experience is just an experience of some part of the universe, some teeny little part of the universe. The wind touching your face. One act of making love. Tying your shoes. Being angry with a student. It's just one part, tiny part of the universe. Yet when it's experienced completely, it links to the entire universe, which is a paradox. And it also links to the source of the universe at exactly the same time. Freedom means the ability to have complete experience when it's appropriate to. Human beings are in some ways intended to be amphibians. We are intended by nature to be able to live in two worlds, to go back and forth between those worlds. A frog's very happy because a frog is a creature of two worlds. When it's appropriate to be on dry land, it's completely comfortable on dry land. When it's appropriate to be in the water, it's completely comfortable in the water. It can go back and forth anytime it wants, as frequently as it wants. And if it gets tired of the water, it can go to dry land. If it gets tired of dry land, it can go to water. There's no impedance in its freedom to traverse back and forth between two realms. We human beings were also meant to be that way, to be able to go under the water of oneness into the world of fluidity and connectivity, and then to come out into the solidity and aridity of dry land for certain kinds of functions. But the problem is, we forgot how to get back into the water. And now we're stuck in the solid, arid, terrestrial zone. We have no way to refresh ourselves. We have no other perspective on things. And we can't even really appreciate the solidity and the aridity of the land. We can't really even appreciate that because we have nothing to contrast it to. A liberated person is like the frog. They're able to appreciate the congealed world of separateness and individual self in an entirely different way because they have the option of going into the fluid, connected world of complete experience anytime they want. This is our basic model. But that's the theory. Where does one start? The theory is extremely elegant. It has all the marks of good science. Einstein said, a good scientific theory has simplicity, generality, and power. What does that mean? It's obvious what simplicity means, not overly complicated. Generality applies to a vast, wide range of circumstances, and power means that it really gives you a handle on what's going on. The theory that I just presented to you has all of those marks. That's why we can well call it a science of enlightenment. Ordinary experience, we know what it is, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking. When greeted with mindfulness and equanimity, you now have some sense of what those mean. Catalyzes a process of insight and purification. You now have some sense of what that means. Which culminates in a state of being in which we have the freedom to have complete experience upon occasion in day-to-day life. You have some sense of the awesome nature of complete experience. We human beings think that we want intensity, variety, duration. It's true, isn't it? Well, we want all that, but we also deep down want something else, something that is quite independent of the intensity, variety, and duration of experience. And that dimensionally independent thing is called the completeness of the experience. So that's the theory. It's simple, it's general, it applies to everything, and it's powerful. It really gives us a handle. It dramatically empowers, allows us to stride through life like a colossus. But as I say, that's an elegant theory. In terms of practicality, where do we start? And this is sort of interesting because different teachers take different tacks, different approaches as far as this goes. At one extreme are the teachers that will not give you anything more than the theory. They won't give you a technique or several techniques. They won't tell you to do a formal practice or come to retreats. They will not speak of stages that you pass through or talk about or sensitize you to benchmarks or experiences or explain the significance of the experiences that you may pass through. That's one extreme. There's a reason for that. In fact, there are a number of reasons for that. And that is certainly a legitimate orientation that a teacher might take. Probably the most famous example of that orientation is Krishnamurti. Now, if you've listened carefully to what I've said, you'll see that mindfulness and equanimity are, of course, mindfulness is awareness. Equanimity is a kind of internal choicelessness. So that it's none other than the choiceless awareness that Krishnamurti talks about all the time. But he wouldn't give people technique. He wouldn't give people structure of practice. He wouldn't give people structure of organization. Why? If you give people anything more than the theory, they're going to get caught up in the organization. They're going to get caught up in, am I doing this technique right? Am I making progress? Am I having the experiences that I should be having? Am I there yet? They're going to get confused. Should I apply this technique? Should I apply that technique? There's all sorts of difficulties that come about as soon as you go beyond just giving people the elegant theory of the science of enlightenment. People would come to Krishnamurti, what should I do? Be aware. Well, how do I start? Be aware now. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, be aware of that confusion right now as you speak. But they don't know where to start. One is damned if one does, and one is damned if one doesn't. If one does go beyond just giving people the concept and actually start to systematically instruct people, all sorts of potential problems arise. On the other hand, if one doesn't give people some sort of structure, some sort of path, some sort of sensitization, some sort of technique, or perhaps several techniques for cultivating the mindfulness and equanimity, then what is one left with? The only thing one's left with is to make discussion groups to discuss the ideas of the teacher. That's what you're left with. There's a Japanese expression, Mizu kiyo kereba uo sumazu. It means, if the water is too clean, fish can't live there. If you're too concerned with avoiding the impurities of people's getting attached to techniques, attached to the path, attached to their status on the path, if you're too concerned with avoiding those sorts of impurities, your water may be pristine clean, but fish can't live there. There's no place to start working. Most teachers will give some procedure, some technique, in order to cultivate the mindfulness and equanimity. But here again, there's different possibilities. Where do we start? Any given technique is going to involve two things. It's going to involve picking an aspect of experience to work with, and it's going to involve picking a strategy to work with that experience. For example, if we decide that we're going to cultivate mindfulness and equanimity with respect to the feeling body, I can think of three distinct strategies. The object of meditation is the same, any and all feelings that arise within the body. One strategy, try to evenly cover the body with awareness simultaneously, not losing track of any piece of it to the best of your ability, and accepting the way it feels moment by moment. We might call this a strategy of even coverage of awareness within the body. A second possible strategy would be to systematically sweep the awareness through the body, taking a systematic inventory of each part of the body, either as a continuous wave of awareness or taking the body in segments and spending basically equal time in equal areas of the body. This is a technique that is sometimes called sweeping. A third possible strategy, let the awareness freely float within the body wherever it wants to go. Don't particularly try to control it, but be aware which one or several parts of the body is coming up and infuse them with mindfulness and equanimity as they do, but then be willing to be pulled elsewhere within a few seconds. We might call that a kind of free floating of awareness through the body. These are three very distinct strategies, but they all have the same object of meditation, which is the body sensations. If I started you out with the body sensations and gave you these three techniques, you might get confused, well, which one should I do when, or that kind of thing. But that goes with the turf. Some teachers will just give one aspect of experience and one procedure, one strategy, and that's it. You do the whole path with that. Maybe the aspect of experience is the sensation of the breath touching your nostrils. And the technique is simply to keep the awareness rested on that sensation. And you do it for 20 years, 30 years, through the whole path with just that one aspect of experience and that one procedure. Or maybe the aspect of experience is any and all body sensations. And the technique is to sweep the awareness up and down, and that's it. You never work with anything but body sensation, and you never work with any of the other procedures. You just sweep. The Ubakin lineage of Vipassana, it does have some other things, but it pretty much says the object is body sensation, the technique is sweeping, and that's it. That's your whole path. You don't have to worry so much about other objects. You don't have to worry so much about other procedures. Just do this. And that will take you the whole way, because sooner or later you will have a complete experience of the body. You will have fostered a lot of insight and purification along the way. Ubakin, that's capital U, capital B-A, capital K-H-I-N. It's a Burmese name. You may know in Burma, people that are honored are called U, like the U Thant, who is the Secretary General of the UN at one time. Upandita is another very famous Burmese teacher. Ubakin was a perfect example of how a person can be deeply onto the path of meditation, deeply spiritual, and yet still very efficacious in the external world. Sometimes people are afraid, you know, well, I'm going to have to abandon my ordinary life. I like the theory, I like the practice, but you know, I have family, I have job, I have hobbies, I have goals in my life. If I have to go off to a monastery and give up my householder's life or go into the forest or whatever, I'm not willing to do that. And they ask, you know, can an ordinary person living in the world still become deeply enlightened? Ubakin's a very good model case for that. In point of fact, he was not a monk, but rather an important bureaucrat in the Burmese government. He originally handled the government disbursements of funds when projects had to be done, things like that, who gets paid what. That's an extremely sensitive job, a job which is very demanding, and a job where you have to deal with the pressures of corruption and threats, especially in that part of the world. Anybody doing a job like that is in the real world, for sure. Yet, he was also a great Vipassana master and teacher, taught people. And what he did is, he had it optional that anybody who wanted during the lunch break from the typing staff of the office right up to the chief administrator himself. Any who wanted to could use their lunch break as an hour meditation period. But of course, it wasn't required. And he taught the staff. And of course, efficiency went up, corruption went down, and other departments in the government started to really notice the difference of what's happening in the accounting department here. Eventually, what happened is they made him the head of four departments of government. So he had to run four departments of government and keep all of his teaching activities going. That energy, that vitality to do things in the real world came out of the fact that the internal friction within his being was reduced. If you lubricate your car well, it uses gasoline much more efficiently. In his case, he directed a lot of that into something very, in a sense, secular and mundane, which was efficiently running parts of the Burmese government. When he got to be at mandatory retirement age, they put a special bill through the parliament that he would be allowed to keep his positions because they couldn't run the government without him. There's a really good example of being liberated, being beyond the world, but being efficacious in the world in the ordinary sense. And maybe it's no coincidence that one of his main students, who has now become the main expositor of this particular sweeping technique, an Indian man named Boenkaji, is an extremely successful and wealthy entrepreneur with a big family and really a financial empire all over Asia, but liberated and knows where it's really at. And when he says that wealth is not going to make you happy and the material world and the world of conditions is not where it's ultimately at, you can't say, well, that's just some hippie speaking out of sour grapes that couldn't make it in the real world and so wants to abandon the world. Anyway, you can, like Ubakin, take one aspect of experience, one technique. Or you can give people many techniques for working with many aspects of experience. That has the disadvantage of being confusing, but it also has the advantage of giving a person a lot of options. Because the issue is completeness, it doesn't matter if one takes a small aspect of experience or if one takes the entire sensory field. One can both cultivate mindfulness and equanimity and experience completeness with both little pieces of experience or with big pieces of experience. Typical objects of meditation that people use are the breath, which after all is a body sensation. It's important to realize that the breath is a subset of the body sensation. It is a particular body sensation. And there's any number of ways that you can work with the breath in an attempt to have mindfulness, equanimity, and ultimately a complete experience of the breathing process. You can focus at the nostril, you can focus at the abdomen, you can focus over the whole body. These are different strategies for working with the breathing process. My present teacher, Joshu Sasaki Roshi, likes to have people focus on the expansive quality of the out-breath and the contractive quality of the in-breath. Of course, for most people, the out-breath seems contractive because your lungs collapse, and the in-breath would seem to be expansive because your chest inflates. And indeed, that is true. But if you look at a very fine level, at a very subtle level of the coloration of your consciousness, you'll see that on the in-breath, the diaphragm, the intercostal muscles, they all contract, which is a contractive quality. Also on the in-breath, a vacuum is created that pulls the linings of the tissues inwards, which imparts a subtle contractive quality to the in-breath. On the out-breath, the muscles stretch, and that vacuum on the tissues releases, so there's an actual subtle expansive quality. So if you want to tune into the subtle coloration of consciousness gets colored contractive on the in-breath and expansive on the out-breath. But from another perspective, you could say that the in-breath is subtly contractive, but at the same time also superficially expansive. And the out-breath is subtly expansive. At the same time, exactly simultaneously, it is superficially contractive because the chest, which is the more superficial aspect, the more obvious mechanical aspect, collapses. So actually there's a simultaneous presence of both expansive and contractive qualities on both the in and the out breath. Now that's a very unusual way of focusing on the breathing process. I don't know of any other teacher that teaches that, but it's very powerful also, because it gets you in direct contact with the fundamental forces of expansion and contraction right in your breath. So there's a lot of different ways of working just with the breath. I remember when I first started to meditate, the object that was given to me was, in fact, the breathing process. And when I started to get pretty good at it, started to get fairly focused with it, I went to my first teacher and I said, you know, I'm now, as you instructed me, able to develop a high state of samadhi with the breath. Would you give me a more advanced meditation? And he was a Zen teacher. He sort of looked at me and he said, there are people that have been meditating on the breath for 20 years and they're still learning new things every day. And you're asking for a more advanced meditation now? Well, I guess, sort of stymied me, okay. He said, okay, if you want a more advanced meditation, so to speak, quote, more advanced meditation, I'll give it to you. I want you to find out who you are. I want you to be able to answer the question for me, who are you? Okay, sorry, I asked, right? Where do I start? How do I start? Okay, well, this is one of those Zen things, right? How do I start to answer that question? And he said, just do it. Just do it. And I said, can't you sort of give me a hint how to start to do it? He said, turn the light back on itself. Now go do it. And I groped for 4 years. Groped. What does he mean? Find out who I am. What does he mean, turn the light back on itself? And I just groped. I didn't really know what I was doing, but I had a lot of samadhi. I had a lot of concentration. I wasn't groping in the sense of speculating with my mind, trying to understand conceptually. It was more like a feeling groping back deeper and deeper and deeper into my being, like you're reaching back behind you. You can't see where you're reaching, but you know you're going in a certain direction. After 4 years, one morning, and it was actually an afternoon, I'd sort of been studying all day, and I realized I hadn't done any sitting that day. I sat down. Whenever I sat, I was working on this thing, right? So I just sat down. The thought arose, who am I? I felt the outline of my body, and I felt the sense of my individual self, and then something incredibly dramatic happened. I got a piece of the answer, and I was never the same after that, never the same. I walked around for days and days and days, just ecstatic. But it wasn't a peak experience. It never wore off. It was a fundamental change in one's understanding. Years and years and years and years and years later, in retrospect, I realized what happened. In the moment that I sat down, when my sense of individual self arose as thoughts and feelings, for that moment, there was perfect mindfulness and equanimity covering the entire sense of self, both the tip of the iceberg and down to the base of the unconscious thoughts and feelings that give you the sense of self. The whole thing was perfused for just a moment with perfect mindfulness and equanimity. I had a complete experience of the small self. But when you have a complete experience of the small self, you're never the same again. I just started to laugh. I mean, I just got up and some negative thought went through my head, and it wasn't me. It was just going through like a cloud. It wasn't me. And I just laughed, and then I noticed that the walls were laughing with me. They were participating in the mirth of the moment. For real, there was absolutely no difference between inside and outside. That's so it goes. You can start out with something like the breath as your object of meditation, or you can start out with something rather more challenging, investigating how does the sense of self arise. That strategy is used in certain Hindu schools. Ramana Maharshi made that his main practice. He called it Atma Vichara, the investigation of self. The sense of self is a pretty challenging object to start with because it involves both thought and feeling. You could narrow your object of meditation to just feeling any and all body sensation. That's where I usually like to start people out because the feeling is so tangible in the body. It's three-dimensional, it's observable, it moves fairly slowly in time, unlike the mind, which is extremely difficult to observe. The feeling body is very primitive, not in any pejorative sense, but it's very primordial, so it's quite close to what we call the unconscious. And therefore, when you infuse the body with mindfulness and equanimity, it's a direct conduit into the unconscious. That's one of the reasons why the body sensation is a useful first object of meditation, any and all body sensation. And of course, when we have emotions, anger, fear, sadness, embarrassment, hurt, feelings, guilt, whatever, the feeling part of all of that is in the body. So if you work with body sensations as an initial object of meditation, it's quite practical in the real world when things come up. One could theoretically work with the thinking process as one's initial object of meditation. That's very challenging. Most people find it very difficult to infuse precision and equanimity into the thinking process. But of course, when you can do that, you have a wonderful tool because the core of an adult is all centered in the thinking process. That's why it's so difficult. That's where our identity is centered. When we were babies, our identity was centered in the feeling process in the body. When we become adults, the thinking becomes the center of things, and the body becomes peripheral. A lot of people consider thought to be the enemy of meditation. It's like meditation means getting rid of thought or somehow turning off your mind or making the mind blank. That is possibly an aspect of meditation, but that's not really a deep understanding about the nature of thought. Thought is just one of the six senses. It's every bit a part of nature as hearing or seeing is. The only thing that is different about thought is that there's an extraordinary amount of unconsciousness and fixation associated with the thinking process. As soon as any little thought comes up, it's gotcha. It's you. And it has to be played out. And in being played out, of course, it kicks up a whole bunch of other thoughts, each one of which is you, and has to be considered and has to be played out because it's a thought. And I am my thoughts. There's an enormous amount of fixation on every thought that comes up. There's a drivenness. The cure for a thought is more thought. The cure for this thought is more thought. And the cure for this thought is more thought. So that there's a drive to think. When there's nothing appropriate to think about, when you don't need any thoughts, random thoughts come up out of nowhere for no reason. Total non sequiturs. Sooner or later, one of those non sequiturs becomes a significant thought and we're off again into the drivenness and the fixation. It's not thought itself that gets in the way. It's the drivenness and the fixation around the thought. And the whole purpose of meditation is to diminish the drivenness and fixation. When you finally are able to think without drivenness and fixation, then your ordinary thoughts turn into transcendental wisdom. That's the only difference. The only difference between insight and monkey mind